We want the sleighs for wood. The men shouted. Get back. The lieutenant screamed in reply. The forest is full of wood. The Lancer stared at him, wondering what good the sleighs would do them if they all froze. A party sent out to fetch wood from the forest ran to the shelter of the trees. Faceless specters returned with bundles which they threw down onto the dying fires. The fires had to be kept alive, which made rest impossible. We prayed that the Russians wouldn't attack, all attempts at defense had been abandoned. Guard duty was the hardest of all. To stand still one seriously risked being frozen alive. At 9 o'clock it was my turn again. 15 of us were standing watch in the ruins of a building crusted with hard snow which cracked like glass. We got through the first half hour beating each other to keep our blood moving. The second half hour was torture. Two men fainted. We thrust our stiffened hands from our sleeves and clumsily tried to help them. Our gloves, part wool and part leather, were already full of holes and good for nothing. The pain in our hands and feet seemed to travel through our bodies and clutch at our hearts. Four men carried the unconscious soldiers to the fires which gleamed in the darkness. If the Russians had come, they could easily have wiped us out. One man was running round and round in small circles, crying like a baby. The pain in my feet made me scream aloud. Despite orders, I abandoned my post and ran to the nearest izba. Shoving my way through a compact mass of soldiers, I stopped just short of the fire, and fell grimacing to my knees. Then I thrust my boots right into the coals. They immediately began to crackle and hiss, and at the pain of contact between hot and cold I burst into loud sobs. I was not the only one to cry, and there were others whose screams and moans were far louder than mine. The hour of release finally came, and we prepared to leave. The Russians had not swarmed down on us, and the steel of our frosted weapons, which had not been heated by explosions, glimmered bluer than ever in the horrible cold, and looked as brittle as glass. Our men assembled listlessly, torn by a conflict of disloyalties which brought them close to madness. Although no one had covered himself with glory fighting against the Russians, another fight, which was equally formidable, had been fought against the cold and our exhaustion and filth and the lice we scarcely felt, they had become so much a part of our everyday condition. The cold had also claimed its victims. Three times, detachments of the last group on guard had returned to the fires carrying inert bodies, pneumonia, generalized frostbite, and physical weakness had been unable to resist the overwhelming cold. For three men, their return to the fire came too late. Five others were revived by flagellation and alcohol. In the motionless cold of the polar night, we covered the rigid corpses with snow, marking each improvised grave with a stick and a helmet. There was no time for sentiment or reflection. Those who were still, to their astonishment among the living, were trying to shake off the general numbness enough to start our solidly frozen engines. The situation seemed desperate. Not one of the engines turned over. Feldwebel Sperlovsky stamped down on the pedals of his Zundapp, which resisted the pressure his 190 pounds of flesh and bone could still bring to bear, and then cracked like a piece of dead wood. The metal itself seemed to be affected. We lit fires under the panzers, to try to thaw them slowly before making any attempt to start them. For the cursing, gasping Lancer, the effort was immense, straining our congested lungs, which whistled and rattled. Wezridow himself was impatient. He had wrapped his boots in rags picked up during the retreat. We should have kept at least one engine running all night, he exclaimed. It's elementary. This sort of carelessness could ruin all of us. We listened to him with expressionless faces. Undoubtedly several among us would have regarded death as a deliverance. An hour or so later, we heard the asthmatic backfire of an engine. Someone had managed to start one of the half tracks. The driver let it warm up for a while, and set to work on the gearbox, which had not yet thawed. After 2 hours of intense effort, our column set out, under orders to maintain the lowest possible speed. Until the machines had reached a certain minimum temperature, we had to limp after them on foot. At midday, there were several breakdowns, and the convoy had to stop. The radiator hoses of several vehicles had been damaged by the pure alcohol in the radiators, and we had to repair them, using spare parts if we were fortunate enough to have them. Otherwise, we patched them up as best we could. While the work was in progress, we opened some cans of solidly frozen food, meat which could be chopped with an axe, a puree of peas and soya with the consistency of cement, and a solid brick of wine. Our enforced stop cost us an hour. According to radio instructions, we had one more hour to rejoin the main body of troops. We were crossing the territory of one of our interior defense posts, two round blockhouses and three or four huts built into the ground. No one came out to meet us, and the place seemed deserted. However, a plume of smoke was rising from one of the blockhouses. No doubt the men inside were asleep beside a warm fire. We sent a small group over to investigate. 5 minutes later, one of them ran back to the column, his breath spreading around his face in white clouds. When he reached us, he stopped, gasping. "Everything in the has been destroyed, Herr Hauptmann, and everyone is dead. It's terrible." Every gray face filled with anxiety. Looking more closely, we saw that the doors of the Isbas had all been knocked in, and that four or five bodies lay beside one of the huts. "Partisans," someone shouted. "Six men recently killed. There's been fighting here recently, Herr Hauptmann. Those bandits must still be holding their guns." Another detachment went into the second blockhouse. There was a long, echoing explosion, and a geyser of earth and snow and fragments of wood shot into the air over the building. Wesrida cursed aloud, and ran toward the smoking bunker. We followed him. Three men had just been torn to pieces. Two were unrecognizable, while the third was gasping his last breath, rattling as the blood spurted from his body. Mixed into the rubble lay the bodies of four German soldiers who had been killed before we arrived. "Watch out for mines," Wesrida shouted. The word passed from mouth to mouth. Soldiers stopped at the door of the second blockhouse and looked in without daring to enter. Six men, who had been stripped almost naked and hideously mutilated, were lying in pools of black, congealed blood. Some of the mutilations were so horrible that we couldn't look at them. Two soldiers, men who had fought outside of Moscow, Abursk, Bryansk, and Belgrade, and seen appalling horrors, hid their faces in their hands and walked away. None of us had ever seen anything so gratuitously horrible. Taking infinite precautions, a section removed the cadavers. Two of them had been booby-trapped. We covered their bodies with debris, as we had neither the means nor the time to dig graves. To all of us, the tactics of the partisans seemed more ignoble and senseless than anything else we'd seen. Wesrida led a ceremony of final farewell to the 18 massacred men. We removed our hats and caps and helmets, and stood bareheaded in the snow. Ekaterin came ridden. Our funeral song rang through the Stone Age setting of Russian winter with the discordant sonorities of thousands of voices. There were no flags or fanfares, only profound consternation. The spirit of revenge motivating the terrorists further destroyed the fragments of understanding so far spared by the war. Our men could not accept it. If they could still bear the torment of the trenches with heroic resolution, they could not accept the treachery of the partisans. Our column set out again. As we passed the center blockhouse, we saw the corpse placard thrust into the snowy mound. Across it, scrawled in charcoal, we read the word revenge. We drove on for another hour. The snow, which deadened the noise of our vehicles, also intensified distant sounds. Suddenly we heard the crackle of automatic weapons. Wesrida, together with our two other officers, ordered us to halt. Immediately, we heard the noise of firing more distinctly. Some 5 miles to the west, fighting was in progress. We were ordered forward on the double. The tank crews wanted to go on ahead and rush to the scene of combat, but our officers couldn't allow them to leave the column. We had to stay together, with our tank tractors each pulling 3 Russian sleighs loaded with men and equipment. The half-tracks helped the trucks, which would never have been able to make it alone. I was riding on the third sleigh of one of these trains. behind us was a large sidecar whose transmission was failing. The tanks were pulling with full power, to the great peril of their own mechanisms. The crackle of guns grew continuously louder. Suddenly, Wesridow stopped the convoy and jumped down to check his maps. Everyone on the sleighs was ordered to follow him, and I found myself going into action once again. The panzers detached themselves from their trains and drove toward the noise. We followed, running as fast as we could, waved forward by Wesridow, who came with us in a large BMW sidecar, a Steiner with an 8-ton. Mortar skidded past us in a cloud of whirling snow. Gasping for breath, we ran along the track made by the tanks. They had pulled far ahead of us and entered into combat with the enemy some 10 minutes before we reached the scene of fighting. We could hear their machine guns ripping into the air, sounding much louder than usual. The sidecar came back toward us and suddenly spun round. Spread out into the forest. We carried out the order, some of us remaining behind to pull out the sidecar, which was stuck in a drift, before running on through the trees, standing up as straight as the masts of ships. The virgin snow rasped and cracked in great sheets under our weight. We could no longer see the tanks, which seemed to be pursuing an enemy in flight. We didn't meet any partisans ourselves. 20 minutes later, a flare called us to the nearby blockhouse, which was like every other. It was supposed to guard a track, which in normal times was heavily used. The post had been attacked by partisans which, of course, we had to expect probably the same band that had massacred the men we'd found earlier. Here, fortunately, there had been time for the defense to react. Of the 22 men holding the post, 6 had been wounded and 2 killed. Some 20 enemy dead or wounded lay on the trampled snow. There were also several guns, Russian and German and some American. A few wounded partisans were trying to crawl into the forest. No order could have stopped our men. They fired at the Russians and put an end to their suffering. 2 shaggy prisoners had fallen into our hands. Their eyes rolled wildly like the eyes of trapped wolves, and they answered our questions with absurd, repetitive replies. We. Not. Communists. What did they take us for? Or did they really know nothing? That, of course, was possible. They looked like beasts being dragged to slaughter. No talk was possible, and our men were muttering for revenge. Wesridow looked at the partisans, and then at us. He tried a little longer to get something from the prisoners, but his efforts were unavailing. Finally, his patience exhausted, he raised his arm with feigned indifference. Our men grabbed the 2 prisoners and pushed them along in front of them. The human wolves looked back, snarling. But the sight of our guns made them lose their heads. They began to run, and ran until the first volley caught them and knocked them to the ground. The post had been saved at the last possible moment. According to the men who'd been there, at least 400 partisans had attacked them, and the fighting had lasted for over 2 hours. The men greeted us with bear hugs. They were overjoyed to hear that we had brought an evacuation order with us. For the moment, we seemed to be acting as the last broom of the Wehrmacht, making a clean sweep. To crown the misery of the day, a hideous incident occurred within 10 minutes of our departure from that place. The sidecar at the head of the column, preceding the first tank by some 30 to 40 yards, drove back onto the track, moving through the snow with considerable difficulty. A tank followed it, rolling over the same ground. Suddenly an explosion shook the earth and reverberated through the air. Frozen snow showered down with a crystalline sound from the heavily laden branches all around us. The tank had been blown off its tracks and torn open from below. We could hear the roar of the flames as fat plumes of smoke rolled out from beneath the machine, spreading over the icy ground. The men on the sleighs which followed reacted immediately. One of the junior officers jumped onto the turret of the tank to try to free the frantic men inside, who were probably seriously wounded. Others ran to help, while the infantry spread out on either side of the road, to be ready for any eventuality. By now the tank was wrapped in thick black smoke, and we could do nothing to help the trapped men. We emptied 3 extinguishers onto the blackened metal, but the flames inside only increased in violence. The sleighs were hastily drawn back, as the tank's reservoir poured out 40 gallons of flaming gasoline, which spread across the snow. In panic, the scorched Lancer yielded to the fire whose black plumes of smoke were climbing into the dark sky. In helpless anger, officers and men alike watched the immolation of three men. The smell of burnt flesh mingled ignominiously with the smell of gas and oil. The two men in the lead sidecar had passed over the same spot a few seconds before the tank. Their tires must have missed the detonator of the partisan's mine by only an inch or two. They also watched the hideous scene with cold sweat running down their spines. The column abandoned the burning tank, whose flames had begun to make its ammunition explode. We also abandoned three heavy sleighs, and some of our materiel, which we burned. The men who had ridden on those sleighs found places on other vehicles. We all made a wide detour to avoid the exploding machine gun bullets. We left behind the tomb of two men who had been killed without a chance to defend themselves, two men who had 3 years of fighting behind them and who deserved Valhalla. We abandoned the territory to the red waves that followed us. This was the final passage of the last European crusade in the complete sense of the word. The piercing cold was a continuous element we could never forget, even during moments of strong emotion, as in our recent clash with the partisans. A short time later, we rejoined the division in a town of a certain size and importance called Boporovska, if I remember correctly. Between the trenches and the barbed wire, the engineers and the TOT organization were busy mining the area. Other infantry regiments and an armored unit equipped with Tiger Panzers had also reached this point. A dozen of these motionless monsters seemed to be grinning at us as they watched the passage of our battered equipment. The presence of the Tigers reassured everyone. They were like steel fortresses, and no Russian tank could equal them. Several Wehrmacht civil servants had been billeted at Boporovska. These gentlemen were surprised and displeased to find themselves suddenly at the center of a battlefield. They all seemed to be in an extremely bad humor, and their attitude toward us seemed tinged with a certain distrust. Perhaps their bureaucratic minds resented our fighting as we retreated. For them, Russia meant this organized town where one could shelter from the cold and eat one's fill, provided one had established the proper connections with supply. Perhaps there were also charming evenings with the charming Ukrainian women who seemed to abound in these parts. These ladies and girls seemed to be preparing for a hasty departure in the company of their gentlemen friends, to look for a distant and more tranquil spot. We, it seemed, would be given the honor of defending these bureaucratic love nests. This attitude infuriated us, and many brawls began, but were quickly stifled. In the end, we were too exhausted and hungry to bother with these people, and occupied the warm izbas we were given with the greatest satisfaction. In the izbas we found food and drink and the opportunity to Washington. Our cabins were rarely equipped with candles or lamps, but the flames in the fireplaces, which we fed with every combustible substance we could find, brilliantly lit these fragments of paradise. Within a few tours of our arrival, several cubic yards of snow had been melted in each billet, and we were all stripped naked, scrubbing off our filth as best we could. We soaked our trousers, underwear, shirts, and tunics with feverish, almost panicky haste. Our opportunity would certainly be brief, and everyone wished to make the most of it. Someone had even found a box full of small cakes of toilet soap. These were mixed into the water of the largest tubs. In turn, timed by a stopwatch, we plunged into the warm, foaming bath, 2 minutes each and no overtime. We joked and larked as we hadn't done for months. The water spilled over the edge of the tub, and flooded the big room, where some 30 shadowy figures cavorted. We kept pouring water into the tubs, to keep the level up. The dim light prevented us from noticing that the foam which so delighted us had turned grey with filth. However, our Lystida scented death, Marie Rose. When we had finished washing, we emptied the tubs into a hole we had dug inside the izba. There was no question of going outside. The thermometer registered 20 degrees below zero, and everyone was naked. When the water was gone, we broke up the tubs and burned them. The fire had a voracious appetite, which was difficult to satisfy. Hals was exultantly chewing a fragment of soap, laughing and shouting that he had to clean his innards too, as they were probably just as filthy and overrun with lice as his skin. "Now the pop-offs can come whenever they like," he shouted. "I feel like a new man." The door suddenly opened, letting in a blast of astonishing cold. Everyone howled in protest. Two soldiers stood on the threshold, their arms loaded with delicacies for the table. We gaped at this gift from heaven as the soldiers laid down their burden on a pile of damp overcoats, a string of spicy wurst, several loaves of gingerbread, several boxes of Norwegian sardines, a brick of smoked bacon. There were also 8 or 10 bottles Schnapps, cognac, Rhine wine and cigars. The fellows kept right on emptying the huge pockets of their coats, and our shouts of astounded delight seemed to shake the flimsy walls. "WH. Where did you find it?" someone asked, almost sobbing with joy. "Those goddamn bureaucrats were really living it up, Gransk, our company cook, never saw anything like this. Those bastards were keeping it all here. They were ready to run off with it, too. This is just a small sample, but they're all as mad as hornets, said they'd report us for stealing personal possessions. Who the hell do they think they're fooling? They can take their goddamn report, and anytime they like I'll tell them what they can do with it. To hell with them." Everyone plunged into that astonishing mound of delicacies. Halsey's eyes were starting out of his head. "Keep my share for a minute," he said, pulling on his damp clothes. "I've got to have a look for myself, and bring back some more. Those bastards think they're going to leave us to take care of the front while they clear out with all this delicatessen, for God's sake." Hals wrapped himself in a Soviet eiderdown and rushed out into the cold. Solmu, a young fellow who was half Hungarian and had joined the regiment under more or less the same circumstances as I had, went with him. When they had gone, Pastor Fahim, aided by Obergefreiter Lenzen, and Hoth, Lenzen's number 2 man at the Panzerforst, divided up the food. We had to hack the bacon with our picks, because our bayonets were too blunt. Fahim, who must have left some of his religious convictions on the east bank of the Dnieper along with his virginity, was swearing like a pagan. "To think that this damned thing which has already poked holes in plenty of guts should be stopped by a goddamned piece of bacon. Borrow some dynamite from the tot if you have to, but hurry up with it." No one was cheated. The amazing sense of comradeship and unity of the Wehrmacht held, and everyone received a fair share. The war had brought together men from many different regions and walks of life, who would probably have mistrusted each other under any other circumstances, but the circumstances of war united us in a symphony of heroism, in which each man felt himself to a certain extent responsible for all of his fellows. The bureaucratic attitude which had been preserved in this relatively peaceful atmosphere astonished rather than shocked us. We felt that it was perfectly legitimate to plunder these stockpiles of hoarded goods. The sense of order which was part of National Socialism was still very much alive among the troops who were fighting for it. Those who appropriated delicacies for themselves while combat troops were dying of hunger seemed to belong to another species. Fahim spoke of all this as he ate, comparing these officials to the bourgeoisie Hitler speaks of in Mein Kampf. Combat troops have immediate concerns. For men living the lives of hunted beasts, all leisurely conversation is a waste of time. We had to eat and drink what and when we could, and make love when we could, without taking any time for eloquence over the girl's hair or eyes. Every moment was precious, every hour might be our last. Halsey's and Solmer's shares waited for them inside their helmets, which were turned upside down. We sang as we emptied the bottles. Our friends who'd gone out for more didn't come back, and later Hals cursed that impulse. He and Solma had been caught pinching some cognac from one of the bureaucrats, which meant 6 days of detention for both of them. Stinacht. Heiligenacht. Oh. Weihnacht. Christmas night, 1943. The wind howled through the labyrinth of trenches north of Boporovska. Two companies occupied the positions prepared by the security division and the Todt organization, which had since withdrawn to the west, beyond the Bessarabian frontier. We had settled into these ice-coated molehills 2 days earlier. The front seemed solid, and we would almost certainly be fighting soon. The collapse of our southern front had forced this last retreat and regrouping along this line. The vast Soviet thrust was moving inexorably and slowly toward us, like a steamroller. We were well aware of this, and the continuous build-up of reinforcements in our sector led us to foresee a violent clash. The country immediately around us was hilly and wooded. Tanks and mobile artillery waited in the frozen underbrush and terrible cold, which stripped the bark off the trees. The stocks of provisions in Boporovska had been repeatedly plundered. Our commandant had tacitly consented to a few days of carousal, as if to compensate for the impending Holocaust. It was Christmas night. Despite our miserable circumstances, we were filled with emotion, like children who have been deprived of joy for a long time. Under our steel helmets and behind our silent faces moved a crowd of glittering memories. Some men talked of peace, others of childhoods which were still very close, trying to hide their feelings and hopeless, ludicrous dreams by hardening their voices. Wezridar made his round of the trenches, talking to the men, but his words seemed only to be disturbing private reflections, and he soon withdrew into his own. He too undoubtedly had children and wished to be with them. Sometimes he stopped for a moment, and looked up at the sky, which had cleared. The frost glittered on his long coat like spangles on a Christmas tree. For 4 days we had to endure nothing more severe than the cold. The sections in the line were relieved continually, and the unbearable nights were divided into two parts. Each day brought fresh cases of pneumonia. Frostbite had become commonplace. Twice, I was carried into an izba and brought back to consciousness and life from the brink of death. Our faces were badly cracked, particularly at the corners of the lips. Fortunately, we had enough to eat. The cooks had been given special orders to prepare our food with as much fat as possible. Supplies arrived regularly, which enabled Gransk to produce gluey soups, full of margarine. These concoctions were nauseating but effective. Our cooks had learned something about cold weather cooking from the ingredients of Russian soups. We also took saunas or Stockter treatment which didn't coddle any weaklings. We moved straight from the hot steam into cold showers, a transition so violent that our hearts often threatened to stop beating. Like Gransk's greasy soups, however, these shocks were effective, and we always felt better afterward. Make the most of it, Gransk told us. Eat up and enjoy it. In Germany, kids are going without dessert, so you can have this. Alas, Gransk's words were too accurate. As Paul explained in a letter which reached me in only 6 days, rationing had become very strict. We were getting much closer to our own frontier, and every day the distance from home seemed smaller. Soon Germany at bay would no longer be able to send us even margarine. One morning the Feldwebel's whistles drove us from the overheated izba where we slept. A patrol of Soviet tanks was just over a mile from Boporovska. The cold as we ran outside was like a blow from the butcher's axe. Each man galloped to a precise point. We had not yet reached our positions when the sound of heavy explosions shook the thin air to the west of us. Russian tanks, charging like maddened bulls, had driven onto our minefield. Now it was the turn of Russian tank crews to go up in smoke. Our observers were watching through their field glasses. Almost all the tanks were trying to withdraw the way they'd come. Our artillery remained silent, leaving the tanks to the mines. Firing might even set off these traps. However, three Stalin tanks had managed to cross the minefield and were driving toward the town in a roar of chains and exhaust. With extraordinary courage, they took the fire of our 37 anti-tank guns without slowing down, only to be hit by our camouflaged Tigers, with their terrible 88s. In a sequence as unreal as anything Hollywood could contrive, all three tanks were hit by the first salvo. One turned over and exploded. Another stopped dead like a boar hit behind the shoulder.